From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment.
It is a thrill to have Maya Rudolph somewhere on the planet Earth talking to me right now. As we record this, she has just got an Emmy nomination for, and maybe my favorite character name ever, Connie, the Hormone Mistress. Monstrous, forgive my imprecision, for Big Mouth. We maybe think of her as our Madam Vice President or any of the number of characters you want to name. She is currently starring in the series Loot on Apple Plus Television, and it's her second time working with Alan Yang and his partner, Matt Hubbard, and director Miguel Arteta. Maya, first of all, thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks, Elvis.
I think it's interesting, too, because when you've worked with Alan and Miguel previously on Forever, I found myself thinking about one of the things that you do as an actor that I really kind of love, which is the way your characters deal with being hurt. We can see them kind of wrestling with it and how much of it to expose. You know, even Donatello Versace or somebody, or a real person that you're, somebody more realistic than that. But I think that's really interesting what you do with that kind of characterization.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like both shows have tackled relationship issues, which, I mean, if we're really honest, I think all humans are thinking about relationships to an extent, whether they're romantic or otherwise. But, you know, it's the human the human experience. But yeah, this one in particular is like the disappointment in her relationship is just the table setting for this show. And then once you get into the show, the meat of it really is about someone who realizes that her life is not on the path that she expected. And the pivots that we make in life in order to survive that sometimes end up making us sort of wake up and realize like, oh my God, I didn't plan any of this. And I really didn't ask myself, who do I want to be when I grow up? You know, I woke up and I was living someone else's life for the past 20 years, supporting them as a partner. And now I have to ask myself the hard questions. I saw a lot of change in people during the beginning of quarantine and a lot of people making life changes that were sort of like, all right, life is short. What do you really want? You know? And in this case, this is a character who had no choice. You know, she was disappointed by her husband and therefore was forced to make a choice, which is sometimes the only way people can really, really face the hard questions.
Yeah, we should say this is a character who finds out the hard way that her marriage has come to an end, but she's also living a very public life. As a character, the way she leads life is sort of presenting herself to the world. And so when this part of her presentation has been taken away, she has to sort of ask herself who she really is, doesn't she?
Yeah, for sure. And I love that Band-Aid is ripped off because, you know, you get to the vulnerable meat of somebody so quickly. But the thing about this character, Molly, is that she's not a vapid asshole. There's more to her than just being a billionaire or a billionaire's wife or a tech genius's wife or a supportive partner. And I really don't know how to approach characters any other way than through the personal, you know, who they are. It never really occurred to me for her not to have any sort of vapid dislikability. I mean, listen, Overboard is one of my favorite movies and that's fun too. But I think that this was a choice to make a character who had a conscience and an opportunity to live vicariously through someone who says like, all right, I'm going to use my power for good.
No, I mean, I think that's what's kind of really wonderful about it. That so often these kinds of characters who are sort of swathed in comfort, as you're saying, it's about like, oh, it's a character like Overboard, Goldie Hawn, or even screwball comedies, which just kind of reminds me of, are people who once they have comfort taken away from them, we see they're awful people. And in fact, she is not. Sort of combining the screwball comedy aspect of it with a workplace comedy, we get a chance to see how this spirit of optimism that is under that presentational layer is really a good thing for her.
I love the idea that this is a woman my age who, you know, whose husband cheats on her for a much younger woman who, you know, probably became legal very recently. And I feel like it's, you know, it's the story you hear. We as women hear that all the time. We get, you know, you hear about women getting replaced for the newer model, the newer version, and just addressing that full stop right away and talking about how shitty that is and kind of that and how common it is, you know, and also to have your own faults, to be able to say, you know, I was here, I was present in my relationship, but I was supportive, but I didn't really ask myself if I was happy, you know, and just all that messiness. The messiness is the best place to go because that's where all the rich stuff is.
It's the treatment. I'm talking to newly Emmy nominated Maya Rudolph, who also has a show, which has now been picked up for its second season on Apple Plus TV, the series Loot. One of the things I like about what you do as an actor, and it's really present here, is the way you use the character's physical bearing to tell us who they are, the way they move into a room. And there's something kind of regal about Molly. It feels a little bit like this thing she sort of took on to sort of tell the world who she is. But now that she's had that role taken away from her, she's actually using that bearing to lift up the people that she works with at the foundation. So it is kind of using who she is to make other people's lives better.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, she falls into philanthropy. Again, not a direction that I think she was looking to go towards, and yet grabs it and holds on to it, and then has enough wherewithal and self-confidence to use what she knows to persevere. You know, she has her moment of tears and sadness, and then she looks at this as this great opportunity. I think she's thrilled to know that there's actually something that has her name on it, that she helped create, that can give her a place and her people. And I think just that element of slightly out of touch is probably the comfort zone for me, just as a performer, to find the humor in it. I think her having that sort of regal quality gives her an air of what I like to call my favorite character, which is the confident dum-dum. someone who just doesn't notice how overly confident they are and makes very large mistakes is such a wonderful, rich place to mine. It's one of my all-time favorites. And the dumber, the, you know, assertive quality, the better, because it really, it's fun. It's fun to play.
Even when she's alone, she's not a tragic figure.
I think in order to figure out any character that I'm playing, especially one that looks like a real person and isn't dressed like a drag queen, I have to find the character in it in order to distance it from myself, or it just doesn't, unless it's that rare occasion, it just doesn't feel real, you know, like a character. And I think a character that's not as over the top as a sketch character would be for me is something that I really, you know, I really have to distinguish myself from in order to feel like I'm doing my job. And it's not to say that I can't play regular people, but I think the game in Molly is that there's a character that I click into that really, yeah, is physically different than myself. That's someone who can travel the world and speak to anyone in any language, and is a great cocktail party hostess, or knows how to charm a Japanese diplomat.
Yeah, well, we can see that lifetime of skill she's amassed in being married, she's learned how to use them. But again, I just was really struck by that moment, because I just thought, first of all, this is, I think, some of your best work ever on this show. It comes so much from this really bone deep physical understanding of who she is. And I don't think you've got that other chance to do that often.
Yeah, I guess you're right, huh? It's like I said, I think the instinct for me is to go big. And Molly is big. I mean, she's not me. I'm pretty laid back in comparison. But yeah, I think it is an opportunity to play a woman at this stage in her life and really just unpack what she's experiencing, that is probably the closest thing to a real person, I think, that I've done in a very long time.
Tell me about the first time you met with Alan Yang, because the work you guys are doing together, again, between these two shows, has been really kind of remarkable and gives you a chance to sort of play characters so we can watch reacting to other people. And I want you to sort of talk about how this partnership you guys have has come to play.
Yeah, Fred Armisen and I were looking for someone to create a show with. And we met with Alan and Matt. I'd met Alan over the years before. There was enough of friends in common in the universe, in the comedy universe, that we knew enough of each other that he definitely checked out as a great human being. And so it was really just a way to put our trust into someone that we thought was great and respected. And over time, Alan and Matt have said, you know, we like working with each other because none of us are crazy. But I think it's quite true. I think you get to a point when you realize you don't have to work with people if they're nuts and if they're a pain in the ass. So that said, we had a great, you know, first meeting talking about Forever and what that show could be creatively. So when Matt and Alan approached me about this project, it was so clear and it was so straightforward and also just such encouragement that they asked me to play this type of role, because it's such a it's the first time I'm leading something on my own, and knowing that people that you respect have faith in you and believe that you can do something is such a boon to your ego in terms of wanting to be able to do a good job.
We'll take a break. My guest, who has won too many Emmys to be laid back, is Maya Rudolph. She's starring in Lutz on Apple TV+. Plus, it's The Treatment. This morning, come. Stay with us. For my listener, we're back. It's The Treatment. My guest is Maya Rudolph, who I'm finally getting a chance to talk to here. We're talking about her new series on Apple Plus TV. The show is Loot. I think what came into being with these two shows is they gave you a chance to create a character who you don't have to try, as you were talking about in the first half of the show, about the sketch stuff. You don't have to tell us who that person is immediately. You can give us some time. And again, I'm just talking about the way these women respond to hurt. I guess in Forever, it's just that it was like a whole lifetime of her being in this thing and not realizing that she didn't want to be in it until it was over. It's like, oh, now what? I'm sort of free, but am I? And here in Loot, she built this role for herself, but this production has kind of moved on, but she's still got the part. These moments where something is over, but your life is not over. It's a demanding part for an actor, and you've responded really well in both of these cases.
One thing I've noticed in talking with Matt and Alan about roles that they want me to play or things that they want me to do is that they put a lot of faith in me as someone who can, quote unquote, do both, which I guess means like be funny and be a real person too. I'd never really seen it any other way. I think maybe when I first started working, I thought that you had to choose whether you wanted to be, you know, a serious actor or a comedian. And that's probably because of what people were telling me. But in my heart, I've always approached everything as wanting to do everything. So I never really have a distinction of, I can do both. I can play this and I can also play that. You know, I just feel like in order for it to feel real to me or believable to me, I have to be able to dig deep into those places. And the longer I've worked, the more I've been more comfortable investigating pain through comedy, as not just, you know, covering up pain with comedy. Yeah, I've always been a proponent of somebody who does everything, because that's how my creative brain works. I see people and want to be them. You know, when I was a kid, I would go to a rock show and I'd want to be a musician. And then I'd watch a movie and I'd want to be Diane Wiest. And then I'd, you know, watch Saturday Night Live and I'd want to be Jan Hooks. And I think I have this, you know, component in my chemical makeup that somehow along the line, I just believe that I could be anything.
Stepping into a new role at a point in your life where things should be settled, you've really, again, risen to these two roles. And it's exciting to watch because it's something in sketch comedy, your gift becomes about this territorial thing. You come in and claim a piece of territory for yourself right away. We know exactly where these people are standing in the room and what they're doing. And it's very different here. And I just love watching, you know, you get a chance to use these resources that maybe hadn't been asked of you before.
I feel like for the majority of my time spent at SNL, I really learned that writing or helping create something is the key. And it really helps you establish your voice, not just so that you can write for yourself, but that so that other people can. I love being part of sketch comedy and I love being part of a group so that people can write for you as well. So you can join. I really learned that I had to create for myself because nobody's thinking about me. And that's, you know, me talking like when I was 27 and starting at SNL, you know, no one's thinking, hey, I'd like to put this, you know, mixed girl with moles on her face in this, you know, lead as this character. You know, I'm so singular. I've always been so singular and picky and specific that I really had to create for myself. And the best collaborators that I had working at SNL were just people that know me really, really well. But I thought when I was starting out that acting was people write stuff for you and they hire you. And, you know, you get to be Meryl Streep. Or, you know, Diane Wiest, back to Diane Wiest, who can literally do anything. I thought that what being an actor was until I kind of realized that it was a singular experience I was having, that everybody has a singular experience. And even more so, I think, if you're coming to this as somebody that looks like me and wants to be everything.
I think of this indomitability for you being, you know, a person, this mixed girl, as you were saying, you are singular and you have to do these things because nobody knows about what they make of you. And so much about what the entertainment business is seeing somebody and making a judgment about them, where they fit and what's come before. And right. Because there was nobody else like you doing what you were doing, you had to prove that you could do it. And then suddenly people started to respond to what it is you had to offer.
I remember sitting with my dad and him saying, I think the best thing you can do for yourself is write and create for yourself. You have to have that. You have to do that. And like any conversation that you have with a parent when you're young, you have to go against that and push back. And then years later, I found myself doing exactly what he said. Whether I realized it or not, I was doing that because it's the only way. And this goes beyond race and gender. That's who all of us are. I think more so than others, I think there's no question that this business itself, obviously, if you look at any movie on Turner Classic Movies, you're not going to see a lot of mixed people. So obviously it's pretty predominantly white business in its early beginnings for sure. And through quite a bit of it. But I think it's different when you're different. You gotta find another door, but it's not, you know, the people that should probably be doing it, it's not going to stop them. They just gotta find the door. And I think the door for me truly is live performance. If I'm being totally honest, I think that's probably where I'm the most myself as a performer.
Why do you say that?
I think it's where I feel the most like that Michael Jordan thing that people talk about where you're just like, you forget what you're doing and you're like, oh, this feels right. This feels like what I'm supposed to be doing. I think I noticed it a lot more during, you know, the election episodes of SNL that I came back to do Kamala Harris for. It had been a while since I'd been at SNL. I get to come back sometimes. And this was enough of a time in my life where I just was really looking at it and appreciating it and realizing like, I'm just far more in my body in this way that I like, don't even question it when I'm performing live. And that when I create, that's the best way for me to create. But when I'm shooting something, I'm just way too in my head. And so I second guess just about everything, you know?
Do you really?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. But I think the truth is that it's just easier to do live because then it's over. You don't get to do it again. So you can't really argue with that, can you? I guess it's over.
I guess that's got to be too part of the joy of doing sketch comedy and doing that live stuff is you go in to be an impact player and then you can move on to the next thing. And it's there's a kind of restlessness in you, isn't there?
Yeah. And also I think the connectivity of a live audience is also the other factor. You know, making this show during COVID was definitely different for all of us because like on Forever, we were able to laugh and hang out and congregate and talk about ideas and joke around and you're just immersed in it all together. And this was testing in your trailer before you come to set and everyone's masked and you don't get to see, you know, half of the joke because it's hidden behind a mask. And there's not a lot of congregating and it's changed, you know, the work experience so drastically for now. I think one of the biggest things that was a big part of Saturday Night Live for me was just the camaraderie, just the hanging out with people. I felt funnier when I was around those funny people. We would play. Sometimes that's where ideas came from that we would write the following week or later, is that we would just play. And it's really hard to shoot a show during this time and without that, for me. That definitely is a secret ingredient that's missing. It's not getting that camaraderie of just sitting around and the joy of sitting around with creative people and having that human connection.
The fun of watching you do Kamala Harris is she basically sort of has a kind of a compact with the audience that other politicians wouldn't. Basically, it's the only thing that Goldman said about her, that she's this smart, mixed-race woman who has to put up with all this kind of sort of pettiness around her. You're not winking at the audience, but you're letting the audience, you're letting us know that I can't believe this either.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, she's so confident and bright and sophisticated that it, you know, especially given the circumstances that she's been put in and the people she's been around, you know that she knows exactly what she's talking about. So obviously it's fun to have that sort of wink at the audience. Like, we know she's right. Of course we know. There's no question. Yeah. I mean, that's another extreme of like, there's a confidence in like knowing that you're tremendous too. There's like, that's like the epitome of cool, right? Like to me, like the fun of playing her is how cool she is because she's so strong and intelligent and powerful and just knows herself.
For women of color, doing comedy on television, it's still a proving ground just because so much of that is about sort of blasting through these shibboleths and these archetypes that have existed before and just knowing who you are and what you've gone through, bringing that level of subtext to it, makes the world of comedy much, much more interesting.
It makes sense to me that I existed on a sketch comedy show as just genuinely myself, because that is the way that I perceive myself. I always found it really interesting and kind of strange when I see something saying like, they haven't had an African-American woman on the show since Maya Rudolph. And I was like, that's what I was. I thought I was Maya Rudolph, you know? And I do think it's interesting. It's not always easy to sort of like look at yourself. I was like, oh yeah, I think I forgot that like, I don't think of myself like anybody else. I just don't. I don't see myself the way that people see me. And I honestly, growing up a mixed person in in this country. I think, you know, people definitely see me as a lot as different things. And that's none of my business in a lot of ways. You know, I know the way I see myself, and that's as me. But what that is incredibly malleable and completely unique. I hated that word unique when I was a kid, because that's what I was, you know?
I'm unique. Why did you hate it so much? Because it felt like a brand that was attached to you?
Yeah, it was like another word for like odd, weird, different. You know, I hated it. I hated having to be unique. It was like, you know, this strange thing. I didn't want to be strange when I was a kid. I wanted to assimilate. I wanted to be like the other girls in my class. I didn't want to stick out. I didn't want to be different. And yet, I didn't want to be like anybody else. I wanted to be completely myself, really.
When do you think that you finally were able to accept the mantle of unique? When do you think, well, I'm okay with this. When did that happen for you?
I don't know, because I don't feel like it was ever any point where I went like, oh, I've got this now, you know, but I do believe that having children has been so instrumental in creating more space to appreciate myself, because you see what real, true love is. And these people that you are lucky enough to bring into the world, and you just marvel at their beauty and how incredible biology is, that you can create a human being and they're so beautiful. Like, it just takes your breath away and you go like, I'm that to somebody else. You know, I'm somebody's baby. And when they held me when I came out, I'm sure they were pretty excited. And I can only say for myself that it's just been so incredibly forgiving just to watch these humans develop right before my eyes, in terms of like, you know, we're so hard on ourselves as young people. And then we learn to appreciate who we are as human beings so much later in life when it really needs to be applied earlier, but that's just the way it goes. Yeah. And I also realized like, oh, none of this is going to change. So I better like it.
It's the treatment. My guest has finally come to deal with the burden of being unique. It's Maya Rudolph. She's starring in Loot on Apple Plus TV. And it's been a pleasure to have her here. And I hope she comes back to this again. Still a lot to talk about.
It's really a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you. It's always so nice to talk to you.
Emmy-winning actor Maya Rudolph, who stars in the Apple TV Plus series Loot. She's currently nominated for another Emmy for her voiceover portrayal of Connie the Hormone Monster in the animated series Big Mouth. Up next, the uphill battle to get Bull Durham made. Its writer-director Ron Shelton has written a book on just that shocking subject. For other Ron Shelton interviews, he's done a few with us, and past editions of The Treatment, which announce their presence with authority, they're on deck at kcrw.com/thetreatment. Oh my, it's The Treatment. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
My guest has reminded me he's done this show about four or five different times, and every time there's been a different cathedral recording place for this, so no better time to talk to the man responsible for the new book, The Church of Baseball, The Making of Bull Durham, Home Runs, Bad Calls, Crazy Fights, Big Swings, and a Hit. I'd like to bring Ron Shelton on, but we're out of time because the title of that book alone takes forever to do. So good to have you here, Ron. Thank you.
Thank you. Always good to see you.
Before we get into the meat of the book, which is really your memoir as much as it is The Making of Bull Durham, within industry standards, for the people who, a phrase I'd never heard before this book, perhaps you could define that phrase because it pops up once or twice in the book.
Well, this is a business in which the coin of the realm is the lie. and the unreturned phone call. So you have to quickly learn that at the beginning, it's like, they're lying to me. They just lied to you. And they go, of course they're lying to me. It's the movie business. So you have to accept what is a lie within an industry standard. What's an acceptable lie and an unacceptable lie, even as you try never to lie, but will be forced to lie, as I lay out in the book.
Well, that strain of, how best to put it, politic runs from the head of the studio to an actor auditioning for a part, and it explains why we never see him play baseball in the movie.
No, and it's why you can't tell the agent the truth, and the agent is lying to you anyway, and then the studio has people that are speaking for the head of the studio, but they actually aren't. They're sort of intervening, and then there's all kinds of Steve Bannon-type characters. But that's how it's always been. Christopher Isherwood wrote about it in Prater Violet. Still the best description of the studio system that exists.
I think what's so interesting about the book to me, too, is that the movie gives you a chance to do all the things you can do, which is to manage people, which is to have an understanding of what your strengths and weaknesses are, which is your ability to read people and your interest in hearing these things that make people individual. All these things that are your strengths that I know you for all come into play in the making of Bull Durham, don't they?
Yeah, because it was survival. We're trying to keep from being fired, trying to keep half the cast from being fired and stay on budget and schedule. And all you could do, all I could do, besides fighting with everybody every day, was to show up and shoot the scene the best I knew how under the circumstances laid in front of us, hoping that at the end of the day, it all added up to what I thought it was adding up to. The problem was the studio hated it. And what do you do when you think you're doing it the way you want to, and they're saying, Sarandon doesn't look pretty, it's not funny, nobody will believe Sarandon would end up in bed with Tim Robbins. I mean, this is a year before I become the godfather of their firstborn, you know, and years before it's called the best sports movie, one of the sexiest romantic movies, and one of the funniest movies. So I was being pilloried because I wasn't hitting any of those markers.
It really was, in its way, both an independent film and a studio film. And it sort of suffered because it was in between those two disciplines, didn't it?
I think all movies do, that you try to make an indie-type movie with a studio, they don't know what it looks like. Now, let me say that Orion was still a great place to work. I'd done a movie as a scriptwriter there. I'm in business with Mike Medavoy still, you know.
Who ran the studio.
Look, and Orion made a lot of really interesting movies. That's basically UA.
After UA.
And in that stretch of period that Bull Durham was made, look at all the stuff they did. And their financing wasn't set up well enough, and they couldn't stay alive, but they won more Oscars than anybody, and they had more memorable movies in a several-year stretch.
So much of this is about you as a person, this book, having really, we can look back at it now, a kind of a classic sort of liberal art education, all these disciplines you had as a student. Does that feel like, in retrospect, the kind of the best film school, which is to study all these different things?
I'm a big believer in liberal arts education, even though at the end of when you get your degree, you don't have a clue what you're doing. But more doors have been presented to you that you can go down and explore. You know, I was an English major, for crying out loud. And I believe in college. I don't believe it's right for everybody. I believe liberal arts is a great way and not worry about what you're going to be doing at 24. You know, I was exposed to reading, I was exposed to movies, I was exposed to a lot of things.
But fine art as well, though. I mean, there's the artistic pursuit that you had in school as well.
Yeah, there was one teacher and I was his only student, the visual art guy. And later I got a Master of Fine Arts in Painting and Sculpture, but after baseball. But all those doors were open through liberal arts.
My guess was pulled a little bit of everything into his education and turned around to write Bull Durham, and also the new book, The Church of Baseball, is, of course, our old friend Ron Shelton. But I just find that it seems like all these things that you did and all these disciplines that you study, brick by brick, sort of gave you the foundation you needed to become a director. Having done all these things, having these understandings of what painting is, so you know what somebody's doing when they're painting a set, and what sculpture is, so you have an idea of perspective. I mean, all these things come into play as a filmmaker, don't they?
Yeah, they do, and I didn't. I was 42 when I got to direct. Now, a lot of people are upset if they haven't directed 10 movies by the time they're 22. I believe in the old system of apprenticeship, too. I mean, you learn and you earn your way up the ladder, or I'm not sure that exists anymore. I mean, the digital world means everybody who's 12 has made 100 movies already because it's just too easy. But they've skipped the step of actually figuring out what the story is and how to write a script because it's too easy. In old Hollywood, it was so hard to move a camera. They were immovable. You know, everything was on a sound stage that they rehearsed the hell out of it, and they didn't shoot it till the scene was as right as they knew how to make it. And now it's, well, we'll fix it later. It doesn't have to be lit right. We'll fix it, you know, digitally fix it. We'll reshoot it because it's cheap to reshoot instead of, well, what's actually the text? What are the words we're going to say and who's going to do what? And I think that's been a struggle. In the beginning used to be the word, and it's not true anymore. Now in the beginning is the package.
What I just found so great about the book, and it hadn't occurred to me until I had the book in front of me, is how all these things you did really sort of informed your first time on the floor. I mean, that you worked as a story editor for a storied independent film producer who made all kinds of films and whose tastes were all over. I mean, he wasn't just working genre. He just liked ideas he was tickled by. And then getting a chance to write scripts. And it's like each thing was a kind of graduation to a thing you hadn't anticipated until you got there.
Yeah, people ask me, how did you get from baseball to filmmaking? And it was a fairly linear evolution. You know, I always liked to write, and that turned into writing screenplays. I always went to movies. I talk a lot about it. I went to movies in baseball because I didn't want to stay in the motel and hotel and watch soap operas. But I never had a class in it. So I didn't come at it from an academic place. I came at it from a more visceral place. Why is the camera there? Why is that story told so elegantly in 90 minutes and the other ones I'm watching for 3 hours and I still don't know what's going on? You know, why the John Ford type movies I responded to, and even Sam's, because everything mattered and everything was there for a reason. Every scene was there for a reason.
Just this idea of ensemble, because in the first film you do, Bull Durham, it really is an ensemble piece because you got three stars in it. But strictly speaking, it's not just a romantic comedy. And so many people are given equal weight. All these movies you saw, too, coming for are all about ensembles. And the directors you mentioned, we knew who somebody was as soon as they opened their mouth.
In terms of all the things I've done and continue to do, I do think they help me as a filmmaker and a storyteller. I don't always get it right, but nobody does. And I've been accused of, Ron, you're awfully well-read. I said, I'm not well-read compared to people who are well-read. I mean, I know, you know, my friend Leonard Oakland is well-read. I have not read, you know, the minor poets of the 17th century, but I'm really well-read for a second baseman in the Texas League.
If that's not a T-shirt, it should be. But I guess what I find myself thinking about, the great story which you tell in the book about how you found your announcer for Bull Durham.
The announcer in Bull Durham, I wanted somebody who was the real deal from down in the Carolinas. It was 3 days before shooting, 3 or 4 days, and I was falling asleep late at night, and the David Letterman show was on. And I woke up, and he was in the middle of interviewing a guest who had the most fabulous Carolina accent I'd ever heard, and he was this short, straw hat-wearing man named Garland Bunting. And I didn't know his name. I couldn't hear it because I missed the start of it. And David Letterman, who loves to own the conversation, could not get in a word. He just pushed his chair back and let Garland talk. He was a revenue agent, a moonshine agent in North Carolina, it turned out. I didn't know any of this. So I called Bonnie in New York the next day, and I said, find out who the guy from Carolina, the revenue agent, was last night, and where is he? It turns out he's Garland Bunting from Scotland Neck, North Carolina. And he'd come back that day, and I drove up that night and went to an all-you-can-eat buffet for $3.99 with him and his wife and hired him immediately and put him in another movie. One of the most interesting men I'd ever met was Garland Bunting.
It's The Treatment. My guest is the author of The Church of Baseball, Making of Bull Durham is the story, but also The Making of Ron Shelton, who is the author of the book. And I wanted to ask you about this because I always thought, and we've talked about this, that the original title, A Player to Be Named Later, which has both mystique and is immediately disposable. I mean, it does so much. It's such a great title.
Yeah, and I mentioned in the book why I didn't use it. A script I'd written 10 years earlier about minor leagues which has none of this and yet the essence of the idea that there's something in the minor leagues. But they had none of these characteristics, none of these relationships. And the title was a player to be named later. And I thought it was too maybe esoteric. It was too...
Literally inside baseball.
Yeah, inside baseball. And slightly, I don't know, Weltschmerzy or something. I mean, what was it? It's like, it was like the Wim Wenders title, you know, the goalie's anxiety at the penalty kick. Or...
Loneliness and the longest runner.
Like, oh, no, this movie's fun. So, Bull Durham, which was a temporary title, it stuck because it just makes no sense. It's the name of the tobacco companies that were not even in existence anymore when I made the movie, but the barns had Mail Pouch or Bull Durham. That was the two kind of barns. And also, not in the book, there was a huge billboard in the ballpark, which is still there, although they have a new one. They still use the old one for high schools and colleges. In right field had a huge billboard, Bull Durham Tobacco. And in front of it was where the extra pitchers hung out. And so one theory is that's where the term bullpen came from.
There's so many things to talk about with this, because you mentioned, given you a story editor, the fact that the movie doesn't have a conventional 3X structure.
Which I didn't discover until I was done. And after preaching the importance of 3X all along.
I always thought that was a way of sort of like basically throwing an elbow at the conventional sports movies, which do have, even to that point, even the Marx Brothers sports movies, the conventional 3X structure, that last structure often gets thrown out. But the fact that the structure is sort of a Shaggy Dog story about narcissism, because that's finally to me what the movie's about. And at a certain point, you grow up and you're not a narcissist anymore, we hope. But the theme to me has always felt as important as, quote unquote, the narrative. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I'm not sure about narcissism. I think it's about a reckoning that each of these people have. Crash is that they've both been playing with boys for a long time. And she's created this fabulous world where she can have a young boy, 19-year-old, and coach him and teach him and sleep with him all summer, knowing he's going to leave in September. Never come back. So she's never, it never has to try the hard stuff of a real relationship. But she knows that. She knows that she can't do this any longer. But she hasn't faced that until this guy Crash walks into her life, who's actually a grown-up and her age and every bit her equal, and just falls for her, but not for her So they're both at a similar reckoning, because he too has to give up something that's worked for him for a long time, but isn't going to work any longer. So what's keeping them apart? Well, they're in their own way, which is all of our problem with all relationships. We know what the solution is. Why can't we get from A to B? Why do we have to go to Z and Q and L, you know? And that's all it is. And how they finally say, okay, what's next? How do we do this? What do we do together? And of course, conveniently, the nuke is removed from the equation by getting called to the big leagues.
But that, again, all these things that happen that shouldn't happen in a sports movie. The person who represents the future disappears from the movie.
And the team. And our hero, other hero, is off the team. So we don't even know what happened to the team. There is no big game. That's the big thing. There is no big game in life or anything. Life ends with a ground ball to shortstop off the fist. It doesn't end with a home run over the center field fence, okay? Or a pop-up in foul territory. That's how it'll end. Not with a bang, but a whimper. There's no big game.
I always thought that this script exists as a way of saying what you think work in sports movies doesn't. Now, it turns out to be that, but that wasn't your intent, which was shocking to me.
Well, I knew there wouldn't be a big game. I knew that because, you know, even though I've had them in other stories, you pay a price. I mean, Woody and Wesley's big game is against two guys from the neighborhood named, you know, Freeman Johnson and Louis Price. And that's a big game in the hood, but not a big game anywhere else. And the cost of it is he loses his girlfriend, who's way hipper and smarter than him and has a bigger future, Rosie Perez. In Tin Cup, he tries for immortality instead of common sense, and he grandly loses, but he gets the girl. In other words, you're not going to get the girl and win the game. Which one do you want?
The American sort of pursuit of not keeping ego in check can lead to your downfall. And Crash and Annie, and even to some extent Nuke, are people who are in love with the sounds of their own voices, who know how to speak and be heard. I mean, Nuke's just trying to figure out what his voice is, but he won't shut up. I mean, that kind of ego, or you're talking about Wesley and Woody and White Men Can't Jump, or Roy and Tenko, these guys, these people who have these great powers of oration. And that's part of who they are, much as anything else. They love an audience. But at some point, don't you outgrow an audience? Because the audience will outgrow you.
But not in show business. People never outgrow the need for an audience. But I mean, what's worse, cheering, booing, or silence? You know, they booed at me. At least they know I'm up here. Narcissism to me is a little more self-loving, which I don't think they have. I think that these people like to show off because athletes like to. That's what they do. And at the end of Bull Durham, everybody is pretty quiet except Nuke, who's rambling on for 42 seconds, all the cliches he's been taught. And that's the sign that he's actually maturing. He's got a sense of irony now and self-evaluation, which he didn't have at the beginning. And Crash and Annie are sitting on the porch like kids. And he says, I want to hear all your theories, but right now I just want to be. In other words, he's stopped performing.
Now, one of my favorite parts of the book is you get to invoke what I think is one of the great American movies of all time, which is Killer of Sheep. And how you get to cast somebody. You're just talking about that scene where Nuke sort of turns the tables on Crash. Well, that's all happening in a scene with one of my favorite actors.
There's a scene that I wrote and shot in Durham where Crash is playing piano in a whorehouse. And as soon as I shot it, I knew this was, Crash can't be in a whorehouse because it's a love story, among other things. And what's he doing there? Well, he was hanging out with his buddy, who was a former minor league baseball star, who was an African-American player, who he has great admiration for, clearly. And he's playing piano. And I didn't buy him playing the piano. I didn't buy anything about it. So when we got back to L.A. and the studio said, I showed the studio the movie, they said, what would you like? And I said, I'd like to reshoot the whorehouse, not in a whorehouse. And they said, have you done the rewrite? And I handed them the same exact scene, except it wasn't in a whorehouse, it was in a pool hall. There's not a line of dialogue that changes. I mean, it's the most amazing thing I've ever stumbled across. Crash is playing pool, shooting pool, and Nuke has come to tell him I'm going to the big leagues. And Crash makes this drunken speech to the owner of the pool hall, the difference between hitting 250 and 300. And I needed to recast that actor. And I wanted an African-American actor who was Crash looked up to. I just got the go-ahead to reshoot the scene, and I'm driving to the editing room or across Hollywood and crossing, I think of Franklin on the Brea or something like that, I see Henry Sanders crossing the street. Henry Sanders was in Killer of Sheep. He was the guy. And I'd met him briefly at a party. And I got to the office and I said, find out who represents Henry Sanders and hire him. He's working in 2 days. And so we became friends and I put him in another movie.
I mean, you talked about reshooting the whorehouse scene, but also there is a scene that basically, as you mentioned in the book, everyone who auditioned for the movie wanted that to do that scene. The scene that kind of felt like the raison d'etre, the spine of the movie.
Yeah, there's a chapter called Kill Your Darlings, and it prints the whole scene that was my favorite scene, everybody who saw early cuts' favorite scene, the actress's favorite scene, Susan Sarandon's favorite scene. And in the screenings of the movie, the editor and I, driving back from screenings, would kind of go, I hate to say this, but you think the air went out of the room during that scene? And I said, I was afraid to say it, but yeah. So we kept tightening the scene, and it worked a little better. And then I said, let's just take it all out. Even though there's a huge story point at the end of it that we just ignore. You know, what do you mean Jim and Millie are getting married? When did that happen, you know? And Millie asked her Susan to be the bridesmaid. That was like a real gut punch thing. So I said, let's take it out. Everybody objected. The producers, the studio, everybody. And I wasn't even sure. And the movie played like gangbusters without it. So the chapter in the book is, what did I learn? And what I learned was the scene was so intimate between them. It's called, he says, why baseball? And she's a 2.5-page monologue of her backstory. And finding her father, dying in Florida and walking out after the funeral and rest home and hearing the noise. It was a baseball. She sat in the stands and saw Thurman Munson. It goes on and on. And I thought, well, without that, everybody's going to say, why is this wild chick at a baseball game? Nobody ever asked. Nobody cared. She just was. The intimacy between them was the kind of intimacy would only come after you'd slept together. You don't talk all that stuff before you know somebody. And what it informs is the big question all screenwriters face is, when in the story do you reveal what information, especially personal information? And how much is it okay for the audience to figure out?
To end, let me take us back to the beginning, because it's what I think your strength is. And we talked about this in so many ways. You talk about it so many ways in the book. Your strength is listening. And finally, you have to listen to the movie as well, don't you?
Yeah, that's why fights over Final Cut. If you have a smart studio or producer, I always say, we won't fight. The audience will tell us what the movie is. You know, the audience knows. We just have to listen to the audience.
But by the way, that didn't even improve the score that much. Take that, that scene out, did it? The NRG score.
No, nothing improved the score. We never got good scores. And I think that's an interesting chapter in the book, how we never scored well in this movie. And people laughed and cheered, and we got lousy scores.
And you were told that never happens, that the movie never does well when it gets lousy scores.
Right. I've learned never to test screen. L.A. is terrible because everybody's in the movie business. And everybody has a script they can't sell in their glove compartment, or their brother-in-law just got fired at Universal. So it's a company town. Go to Phoenix. Go anywhere. Go to San Jose. After all of our screenings, the movie was done, and it was polished, and the music was done, and it was mixed, and the print looked beautiful. And I said to Mike Medavoy, I said, let's get out of town to screen it, because I was sure we were going to score good. So he said, let's go to Palo Alto. Highly educated, professional. So we flew up to Palo Alto. We had a screening. The movie played like gangbusters. They laughed at everything. They laughed at William Blake. Nobody laughs at the William Blake line. I thought, this is unbelievable. And it looked gorgeous. There was so much laughter. It was like a Sturgis movie with the right crowd where you can't hear the next joke. And we come out in the theater. We're waiting. The scores come out, and they've gone down. And we start reading the cards. And they're these articulate, analytical. I just started throwing away. It's like, stop already. Stop. Go get your VC high-tech thing going. I don't want one side of your brain to overrule your experience you just had. And I thought for about 5 minutes they were going to not release the movie. And Medavoy, God bless him, said, I don't know what these cards mean. I know what I just heard and saw in there. And so we held the date and went out, and the rest is history.
Well, so is the movie. And it's 35 years ago this year that you were shooting this movie.
Scary.
The book is The Church of Baseball. Ron, it's always good to talk to you. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks, Elvis.
Ron Shelton, the writer-director who redefined the contemporary sports film with Tin Cup, White Man Can't Jump, and Bull Durham. His new book on that classic is The Church of Baseball. This week, the treat takes us all along the Watchtower and to Jerusalem, courtesy of Ethan Hawke. It's next, and it's The Treatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Ethan Hawke built a career on a studious naturalism, and a career that spans over three decades, from Dead Poets Society to, most recently, the horror film The Black Phone. His newest project is an examination of the actor's life, the HBO documentary series The Last Movie Stars. For the treat this week, he gives us another detailed actor's study, in brief.
My name is Ethan Hawke, and this is The Treat. I saw Mark Rylance do the play Jerusalem, Jez Butterworth. I saw it at its first run at the Royal Court, which was a really small theater. And when I saw Mark Rylance do this production, and I became a huge fan, you realize that he dedicated his life to the theater, you know, running the Globe Theater for years. And it manifests that you felt this whole well of knowledge. I remember my dad talking about, he saw Jimi Hendrix live, and you felt while it was happening that you were part of history, that something was happening that you'd never seen before, like that nobody had, that human creativity was evolving and changing. all of a sudden you knew you're on a different plane somehow. Like they just elevated life. Life just got better, and the temperature, the wind smells different. It was a spiritual evening. I mean, it was like everything I ever wanted from church.
All Byron boys are born with their own teeth. 32 chompers, hair in them's chest, no weeping, no wailing, talking straight off.
If there's some kind of magic actually present in the air, it doesn't matter where you are on stage. Yeah.
This one, me, he sits up, wipes the dew from his eyes and calls, "Mother, what is this dark place?" And she replied, "'Tis England, my boy."
Every now and then I'll see a movie and I don't know how they did that. It's getting harder and harder for somebody to knock me on my ass like that, just because I'm so aware of all the devices and tricks in people's toolboxes. But every now and then somebody does it. You know, the thing that Brecht hated was manipulation. He wanted you to be aware that you were being manipulated. He didn't want to lie to you. And there's something when Mark Rylance is at his best, he's just living. You're not eating a reheated dinner. It's happening right this second. Sometimes as you get older, you think it can't happen again. Like, oh, maybe that's just something for young people. Like, and then it happens to you and you're like, no, damn it. We got to keep swinging. You walk out of the theater with this feeling that all great art, I think, does, which is make you so glad you're alive. And you know that you won't be alive for long, and you just want to live. And this immense gratitude washes over you. I know they're bringing it back, so if anybody has a chance to see Mark Rylance do Jerusalem, I highly recommend it.
Ethan Hawke's appreciation of mastery from Oscar and Tony winner Mark Rylance. Hawke's latest project as director is the HBO Max documentary series, The Last Movie Stars, on Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward. Rebecca Mooney edits and produces the show. It's mixed by Katie Gilchrist. We had help this week from Laura Kondarajan, Anna Buss, and PJ Shahamat. You get more than one treat this week. Keep listening for Music with Ann Litt. To better days, everyone. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.